इसकान फाउंडर आचार्य श्री प्रभुपाद की जय।
राष्ट्रपति वैष्णविंद की जय। नाम आचार्य श्री हरिदास ठाकुर की जय। प्रेम श्री कौशल कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री द्वैत गदाधर श्री वासुदेव गौर भक्तवृंद की जय। श्री श्री राधा कृष्ण गौर गोपीनाथ श्याम कुंड राधा कुंड गिरि गोवर्धन की जय। वृंदावन धाम की जय। चूर धाम की जय। नवद्वीप मायापुर धाम की जय। जगन्नाथ पुरी धाम की जय। गंगा मई जमुना देवी की जय। भक्त देवी की जय। तुलसी महारानी की जय। समवेत भक्तवृंद की जय। गौर प्रेमानंद। All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prastaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharne Nivase Sisanivani Paskutade Satarne Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavam Cha Shri Rupam Sahagujatam Sahagana Raghunatam Vitam Sam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvritam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lavita Shri Vishakam Vitam Shri Panchakalpa Shri Vishcha Kripa Sindhubhya Vachap Tichanam Pavane Gravashan Vibhana Mahanya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 So it's August 8th, 2014 in Laguna Beach, California. And we're going to be looking at all the places in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna talks about how one can find him, how one can find the divine in the world. So I'm going to read just a few of these verses. I'm not going to read all of them. We'll start with the 7th chapter, text 8, which is on page 313. Now this finding the divine in the world, before we read the verses, it's a very pertinent question, because often people think that in order to be spiritual, they have to leave the world. They have to not have a family, not have a job, not have a house, not have a car. When people say things like, oh, he's very materialistic, they usually mean he has a nice house and a nice car. Right? So people think if you're going to be spiritual, you live in a cave up in the mountains. You know, you have one piece of old clothing. You don't interact with the world. And of course, there are many people who've taken up the spiritual path who live like that. But the Bhagavad Gita is specifically spoken to a government officer, to Arjuna, who is he's a prince, and he's also a soldier. And the main message of the Bhagavad Gita is how to spiritualize your life. Arjuna says, I don't want to do this anymore. There's so many problems. Let me walk away and just meditate, just become a mendicant. And Krishna's like, no, that's not the way. That's a way, but it's not the best way. And one of the ways that we can be spiritual in our daily life is to see that really the world and ourselves and our life is never separated from the divine. In fact, the definition of illusion is to think that something is separated from the divine. Krishna explains the definition of illusion in the Bhagavatam. He says, anything that appears to be of value, if it is without relation to me, it has no reality, know it to be my illusory energy, that reflection which appears to be in darkness. So illusion is the concept that something is separate from Krishna, that something is separate from the spiritual. Isn't that interesting? That is, when we say Maya, we say the illusory energy, the material energy, we're not really talking about a thing. We're talking about something which is within the mind. A concept, a paradigm, shall we say. A particular bias, a particular frame of reference, that things are separate from the divine, that things are separate from Krishna. And we tend, when we see them as separate from Krishna, we tend to see them as in relationship to ourselves only. How is this in relationship to myself? We tend to see ourself then as the center instead of Krishna as the center. So these are some very concrete ways, because if you just say, okay, well, everything's related to the divine, well, that's too vague, isn't it? Okay, everything's actually spiritual. Sarva Kalami Dham Brahma. Everything's ultimately spiritual. Everything's related to the divine. Well, that's too amorphous. I can't grab that. I can't do anything with it. It's useless to me. So Krishna's here giving very specific. All right, this is how you can start that search of seeing how everything is actually connected with Krishna. Again, we're not going to read through all the verses, but here in text 8 of chapter 7, Rasoham apsukanteya prabhasmi sashi suryayo pranava sarvavedeshu shabdake purusham nishu. O son of Kunti, I am the taste of water, the light of the sun and the moon, the syllable om in the Vedic mantras. I am the sound in ether and the ability in men. Text 9. I am the original fragrance of the earth. I am the heat and fire. I am the life of all that lives. And I am the penances of all ascetics. Right now on page 315. Text 10. Know that I am the original seed of all existences, the intelligence of the intelligent, and the prowess of all powerful men. I am the strength of the strong. Text 11. Devoid of passion and desire. I am sex life, which is not contrary to religious principles. And then there's another list given in the 9th chapter, and another list given in the 10th chapter, and another list given in the 15th chapter. So I put together these different lists, and I made one master list of all the things where Krishna says, I am. So he says, taste of the water, which we just read. Then in regard to the sun, he says, I'm the light of the sun. Among lights, I am the radiant sun. I am the splendor of the sun. I am the light of the moon. Among the stars, I am the moon. I am the splendor of the moon. I am the moon which provides the juice of life to all vegetables. The splendor of fire, the fire of digestion, the heat in fire, the sound in space, ability in humans, the original fragrance of the earth, the life of all that lives, the living force or consciousness in all beings, the penances of all ascetics, the intelligence of the intelligent, and among women, intelligence, the prowess of all powerful men, the strength of the strong, devoid of passion and desire, and another time he says again, the strength of the strong, sex life, which is not contrary to religious principles, and of causes for procreation, the God of love. Ritual, sacrifice, offerings to ancestors, healing herbs, transcendental chants or mantras, of sacrifices, the chanting of the holy names. Twice he says he's the syllable om. The melted butter, the offering, the father of the universe, the seed-giving father, the mother, the support, the grandfather, the object of knowledge, the purifier, the Rig Samar Yajur Vedas, the goal, the sustainer, the master, the witness, the abode, the refuge, the most dear friend, the basis of everything, the resting place, the giver of heat, the withholder of rain, the giver of rain, death personified and all-devouring death, the generating principle of all that is yet to be, the generating seed of all existences, the eternal seed, the original seed of all existences, the creation, the annihilation, the beginning, the middle, the end. Each of those he says twice. Both spirit and matter. Keeping the planets in orbit by his energy. The air of life that digests food. In the heart giving remembrance, giving knowledge, giving forgetfulness. Among all the demigods, the king of heaven. Of all the senses, the mind. Of all the mountains, Meru. Of all bodies of water, the ocean. Of all immovable things, the Himalayas, of all trees, abandon. Among humans, the ruler. Among weapons, lightning. Among dispensers of law, the god of death. Among subduers, time. Among beasts, lion. Of purifiers, wind. Among fish, a shark. Among rivers, the Ganges. Among all sciences, the science of the self. Among logicians, the truth. Of all letters, the letter A. Inexhaustible time.
Among women, fame. Among women, fortune. Among women, fine speech. Among women, memory. Among women, steadfastness. Among women, patience. Of poetry, Gayatri. Of months, November, December. Of seasons, flower-bearing spring. Among cheating, gambling. Of splendor, of the splendid things, the splendor itself. Victory, adventure. Of those who seek victory, morality. Of secret things, silence. And of the wise wisdom itself. So those are all the things that Krishna mentions. When we look at them, we can understand here is the divine. So I wanted to look at a few of these that we can consider. And again, I'm pulling this. This is from the 7th chapter, the 9th chapter, the 10th chapter, and the 15th chapter. And if there's any of them that you would like to talk about, we could also... If as I was going through that list, there's someone who said, oh, that's one I'd like to hear about. We could talk about that too, even if I haven't prepared for it. So I was thinking about refuge. So we can think about a refuge. It's where we find our shelter, right? So we find shelter in a building. And our body, we think of as a shelter. Our mental capacity, our knowledge, our education, our talents, our skills, our experiences, our family, our friends. What else do we think of as shelter? Window screens, our clothing, sunblock screen, sunblock that we put on our skin, we think of as a shelter, right? Any place that has food and water, we think of as a shelter. Our friends, our family, our government is our shelter. I'm sure we're happy that we're not in some country where there's constant war. I mean, we complain a lot about our own government here in America, but I travel all over the world, and believe me, there's a lot of worse governments in the world. So we think about, you know, our government as a shelter, but all of those sort of refuges, all those places we find, we call a refugee, someone who's looking for shelter, that none of those shelters are permanent, and none of them are sure. Even ultimately, our own body and our own mind is not sure. But we can think about the feeling we have, you know, if any of you have ever held a little baby, like you're holding a little baby against your chest, you know, you're rocking a little baby, and that feeling that the child has of being sheltered, or if you remember when you were little and you fell asleep in the back of the car, wherever your parents were taking you, you were sure it was okay. So to take that feeling and multiply it by millions and millions of times, and that is Krishna. And whenever we have that feeling, I found a refuge. Here is a place where I'm safe. Here is a place where I'm home. Even when I travel, it's always interesting to me whenever I come back to the States. And immediately, I'm home. And that feeling gives us a little idea, just a little idea of what is Krishna. That sense of being safe, that sense of being secure, that sense of being home, of being sheltered, that here I have a refuge, I'm going to have that protection, I'm going to have that safety. Now he also says he's... Yes?
I would just like to add, if it's okay with you.
Of course it's okay. More than okay.
In addition to all of these things, and I say in addition, it might sound not in addition, but a very well-cultivated friendship with Krishna as being the warmest shelter. Of course we enjoy being home, whether home is just being in the country or our home. But if you feel a sense of real friendship with Krishna, this is a shelter.
That is the ultimate shelter.
The ultimate shelter.
Right. So you see it in both ways. Because Krishna is here saying, I'm the refuge. So how are we going to remember? I really like what you said. How are we going to remember Krishna in the world? So one way we can remember Krishna in the world is, you know, I come home from work, I go in my home, here's my refuge. You know, or I'm in trouble, I call my family, I call my mother, I call my brother. Yeah, I'll take care of you, they're my refuge. And we can immediately think, how much more than that is Krishna? Can my home, my mother, my brother always be there for me? Is there a guarantee? And can they absolutely protect me? So how much more, when I get that feeling of... Okay, I'm in my refuge. How much more than that is Krishna? and then to go to Krishna as the supreme refuge. Now, what's interesting is that when you go to Krishna like that, it's not that you don't then appreciate all the material shelters, but you appreciate them as being manifestation of Krishna's shelter. That Krishna's sheltering me through this house or through this brother or through this person. But ultimately, Krishna is the shelter. I think it's also interesting that Krishna calls himself the resting place, Nidasana. So the place where you sleep, like your bed, which Prabhupada translates as the resting place. And you think of this as, you know, where we sleep at night, or our favorite chair, some piece of furniture in which we rest our body, in which we sleep. Or I was thinking of it like you drive on the highway and there's the rest areas. There's a resting place. And then there's picnic tables and there's trees and there's probably a water fountain and things like that. So that these resting places, again, whenever we lie down in bed at night, whenever we sink back into our easy chair, or a mental rest, you know, you're working hard all day and then you have a time of mental rest, of mental peace, a place, either a physical place or a mental place, that whenever we access these, we can again think Krishna is the ultimate resting place. This feeling of relief that I get, you know, oh, okay, here's a break in the journey, here's a break in the day. Here's the sleep given. Of course, Krishna is the resting place in terms of the creation of the material world. Bhutva, bhutva, praliyate. The material world is created and then destroyed. And when it's destroyed, all of us souls enter into the body of the Lord. Any souls who are not liberated enter into the body of the Lord without a body. Right now, we're covered by a subtle body, an astral body, and a gross body. But at the end of each creation cycle, there's a creation, destruction. We enter into the body of the Lord as a resting place. And we stay in a state of like deep sleep for a very long time as a rest. So there's a resting phase in the creation where the Lord is literally, quite literally, the resting place of the living entity. Now, of course, it's also interesting that in the ultimate spiritual world, in the kingdom of God, it's very active. People are very active. They're active, of course, in play. They're not active in work. The word is lila or krida, which Srila Prabhupada generally translates as pastimes, just like we talk about baseball being a pastime. So in the spiritual world, everything is simply enjoyment, and people are active. But yet they're at rest. They're not doing any work. Everything is peace, and everything is relief. So in that way, Krishna is also the resting place. And again, whenever we access any resting place in this world, we can remember the divine and how Krishna is the ultimate resting place. Then he says he's the generating seed of all existences, the eternal seed, the original seed of all existences. So a seed is quite interesting. Of course, we think of seeds generally with plants, but even eggs and zygotes are in a sense a kind of seed. And if there's, in addition to seeds of living beings, there are seeds of ideas. Right? You have the seed of an idea in your mind or the seed of a project. And you think about it, a seed. So a seed has, of course, the living being is there. There's the soul is within the seed. Although the soul within a seed is generally dormant, which is originally a Latin word meaning sleeping. And in addition to the soul, there's all the ingredients for the creation of that particular body. So in the seed of a tree, there's the DNA, there's the instructions. And then there's the beginning ingredients, right? Just to be able to begin. Not everything. The seed is going to have to pull something else from its environment. Of course, like in a lizard's egg or a bird's egg, it actually has everything that it needs. Or at least its beginning body, then it has to get more after it comes into, breaks out of the shell. And in this way, Krishna also contains everything. He is the original life and all the instructions for everything and all the basic things that one needs to get started. That is within Krishna. Now, seeds are also fascinating things because in order for the seed to turn into a plant, it has to stop being a seed. It has to let go of its identity as a seed completely. And Srila Prabhupada's guru, Bhaktisiddhanta, wrote one essay which I always found very heavy, difficult, that when I would read it, I would think, how can this be true? And there he says that there's no such thing as partial surrender to the Lord. He said partial surrender is no surrender at all. And I thought, I don't see how that's true, because it seems that there is such a thing as partial surrender. But if you think about a seed, you'll see how what he said is absolutely true. A seed has to completely surrender and completely cease being a seed, completely break apart in order to become a plant. Now, it's gradual, but it's total. Right? So when you first put the seed in the ground and it comes in touch with moisture, so first the seed starts breaking apart and it turns from a seed to a plant gradually, right? The little root comes out. You've all done this in science class, right? You all remember that far back in school. So the little root comes out, right? And then the two little seed leaves come out, and then you see the outside of the seed, right? Or you see this if you buy sprouts at the shop. You see the root and the little two seed leaves. They're not the real leaves of the plant yet. And then there's a little outer portion of the seed still there. Yes, and then it breaks away. So surrendering all of our false designations will happen gradually, but it does have to happen totally. There's no question of, well, I'm going to hold on to some false designation, to some false idea of myself, and at the same time immerse myself in truth. That's simply not going to happen. It's not possible. Therefore, we say, Sarvapadi Vinirmuktan Tatparatena Nirmala Rishikesha Rishikena Sevana Bhakti Uchite. Sarva Upadi. Upadi means a designation. Designation is, you know, I am an American, I'm an Indian, I'm a Brazilian, I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm brown, I'm green, I'm purple, I'm, you know, I like this kind of thing, I like that kind of thing. Those are all material designations based on this body and this mind, this particular lifetime that we're in. These designations change. In this life, even, they change, huh? What you speak of from one life to the next. And one must give up all of these designations. Simply, I am a spiritual being. I am a part and parcel of the Lord. I am meant to serve Him in a loving exchange. And that has to be done completely. And really, it's this fear and hesitancy of letting go of these designations completely that seems to block most people on the spiritual path. And you find that a large portion of human beings, I'm sure statistically the majority of human beings on the planet, certainly the majority of human beings in America, ascribe to some sort of idea of religion or spirituality. So most people say, I believe in God, or I believe that there's something spiritual. And I see that kind of a belief, which we call in Sanskrit adu shraddha, means beginning faith. Yes, there's something spiritual. Yes, there's a God. But that conviction doesn't put you on the spiritual path. I see it as you're on the material path, and you're simply saying, yes, I accept the existence of another path. I accept that another path exists. I accept that there's an ultimate reality different from the reality in which I'm operating. But you're not functioning in that reality. You're functioning as a materialistic person. And therefore it's explained by one of our great saints, one of our great acharyas, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, that the cleansing of the heart doesn't happen in that stage. That just someone saying, yes, I accept that there's spirituality, that it exists, that God exists. There's no change. There's no change. It's like you're in the seed and you say, I believe that I am ultimately a tree. But that seed is just there as a seed. There's not been any water put on it. It hasn't burst out of its shell. And then the next stage is called sadhusanga. So at this stage is the beginning of letting go of one's false identity. And many people get stuck at this stage. Because sadhusanga, sangha means an association. Sadhu means those who are saintly. So in this stage, you start changing your friendships. You start having friends with people on the spiritual path. Now, as soon as you start doing that, The thing that happens is you start losing friends who are not so spiritually interested. And you don't necessarily have to give them up. They may give you up. They may say to you, you know, you're talking a little bit about spirituality too much. I mean, I remember when I was in college and I was talking about Bhagavad Gita philosophy, and some of my friends would say, okay, that's enough. Let's just go get a pizza. Yeah. And it's quite an upheaval in a person's life. People going through this stage, they'll have a lot of distress, and they'll say, but, you know, I have a family member who doesn't support my spiritual path, or I have a friend who doesn't support my spiritual path, and what do I do? Do I have to choose between this person and spirituality? And unfortunately, the answer is often yes. So that's the first step. You're not really, you haven't given up your designations yet. You haven't started cleansing the paradigm of I'm a materialist, but you're starting to associate with spiritual people. It's almost like the seed is starting to be in a moist environment. Huh? And the covering on the seed is starting to soften. It hasn't broken yet. And there hasn't been any real change, but there's starting to be this little softening, this little change. And then a lot of people start going, whoa, I don't really know if I want to do that. I don't know if what's on the other side? You know, if you think being inside this little seed, you know, and your shell starts softening, and you go, I don't know what's on, suppose there's nothing on the other side. Suppose I'm not really going to turn into a beautiful flowering tree. Suppose that's just a story that somebody's telling me. You know, I've always said I have faith, but. So a lot of people stop there. When they see that if you really want to enter into spiritual life, there has to be some change in the people with whom you're intimate. But you have to at least add to your circle those who are on the spiritual path. And then the next step, called in Sanskrit Vajranakriya, that's when the real change starts to happen. When one starts really practicing spiritual life. So I see the first step, faith, you're still on the materialistic path, but you acknowledge that there's a spiritual path. And the next, sadhusanga, you're kind of turning and looking at it. And then Vajranakriya, you take a step. So there it's like the seed has actually gone into the earth and is getting watered and is getting fertilized. Now, when one takes that step, it's amazing, it's exciting, it's thrilling. When the water and fertilizer pour on the seed comes to life. The soul within the seed wakes up. Right? We know a soul within a seed can sleep for a very long time. Huh? I'm sure all of you have many seeds in your pantry at home. I'm sure you have many beans and rice and wheat and all kinds of things in seed form that are sleeping. And if you were to put some water on them, they would come to life. So we in this world, we've been sleeping probably for many, 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 many lifetimes. It's an interesting sleep that we're in. It's more like being hypnotized. I am not sleeping. I am fully awake. So when we start practicing devotion, it's just like this nourishment is pouring. And we're still in the seed, we start to wake up. And it is one of the most exciting things that happens to a living being. And when people have this experience, this is when people have some amazing conversion experience. Wow! What was that? Because as soon as the soul starts to wake up, it experiences pleasure and knowledge and connection that you never experience in the sleeping state. And then from there, as the water and nourishment, the fertilizer and the water and the warmth of the soil, which is the practice of spiritual life, as it starts waking up the soul, what has to happen? The seed coat has to break, yes? As the soul wakes up, it has to break the seed coat and it has to transform. It has to transform. And then again, a lot of people stop. Wait a minute. I was enjoying the wonderful bliss and ecstasy of waking up. But I don't want to transform. So therefore, the next stage is called anartha nivritti, getting rid of the unwanted things, getting rid of the false designations. And again, many people run away at this point. No, spiritual life is not for me. Or they become superficial. They take up religion. They continue to practice, but superficially. And this is what you see in most of the religions of the world and most of the religious people of the world. They're practicing superficially more or less as a ritual, more or less as a convention, without really wanting to change the heart. Because then one has to transform. One has to let go of all of these false things that were imprisoning us and harming us, but which we become attached to. And when one fully lets go, the final tree looks nothing like the seed, isn't it? How much more glorious is the tree than the seed? How much more glorious? The magnolia tree, the peach tree. So this is our true identity, is we have a glorious, spiritual, eternal body. And the whole process of devotion is compared to this. And then finally, as one breaks out of the ground, then one starts developing spontaneous, natural love for the Lord, which develops into flowers and fruits. Finally, a fruit of love of God, and one enjoys unlimited bliss eternally. So Krishna says, he is the seed. This process of the seed, it's there. Of course, it's there even on a material level. When you want to take the seed of an idea, and you want to take it from an idea, from just an idea to a business, or the seed of a relationship with someone, and you want to take it from that seed to a full-blown relationship, there's transformation. Yes, there's change. There's a metamorphosis. So we think about the caterpillar, how the caterpillar changes into a butterfly or a moth, and how within the cocoon it becomes completely liquid. The old body totally dissolves for a new body to come out. So whenever we see this process, even on a material level, the process of planting, a tomato plant or a marigold plant in your garden, or if you're sprouting some beans in your kitchen, or if you're planting devotion in the heart, or you're bringing something, some seed, an idea to fruition. This seed is Krishna, who contains everything within him for the whole creation. Then he also says, not only is he the seed, but he's the beginning. Now I see a beginning a little different than a seed, because a seed has potential, but it's not really a beginning. So when Krishna says he's the beginning of all things, he says it twice. He says, I'm the beginning and of all creation's beginning. So it's saying you're beginning whenever we start something. Right? You've always wanted to write a book the day you sit down and start writing it. You need to clean your room the day you start cleaning it. Or, you've admired that girl from a distance and the day you walk over to her and say, hi. That beginning. So the beginning of anything, the beginning of everything, that Krishna is the beginning. Anadir Adya Govinda Sarva Karana Karanam. He is the beginning, he has no beginning. He is the cause of all causes. And whenever we have any beginning, what's a beginning full of? A beginning full of hope, right? And excitement and anticipation and energy. Or sometimes it's just full of duty. Okay, I'm going to begin to clean the kitchen. But that's also Krishna. Krishna says, Sarvagatam Brahma Nitya Yagya Pratistitam, that the all-pervading spirit can be found also in acts of sacrifice, in acts of duty, in acts of giving. So that feeling that we get of giving, of duty, the feeling of hope in anticipation, that feeling, that beginning, that excitement, that hope for the future, that vision of what you're going to accomplish in the beginning, that is Krishna, in addition to Krishna himself literally being the beginning. Then he says of letters on the letter A. So sometimes we translate this, or we read it as the letter A, as if it was the English letter A. But Krishna is here talking about the Sanskrit letter A. So A is the sound you make without using your lips or your tongue or your teeth, just A, A. And it's the basis of all sound. Now Krishna also says he's the sound in ether, but this particularly here that he's the letter A is the beginning of all language. And if we think about what language enables us to do, of course the animals have some simple language,
right? This is my territory, or I'm available for mating, or there's a hawk in the sky, or something like that. But at least as far as we know, the animals don't have a language to talk about philosophy. And they don't have, as far as we're aware, they don't have some system of philosophy and spiritual life or some language to communicate it. And how fascinating that as soon as you put form on sound, as soon as you take sound and form it into words with grammar, you can communicate an unlimited number of ideas. Whereas if you have unformed sound, you can hardly communicate anything. Right? The little baby, goo goo. They have a very hard time communicating. So sometimes people say that in order for God to be unlimited, he has to have no form. But really, form makes something unlimited. As soon as you put form to sound, your ability to communicate becomes unlimited. And as soon as sound has no distinct form, your ability to communicate is very limited. So whenever we are communicating anything, everything we're communicating, all of the sounds of language are based on this the breath, whatever different vowel and consonant sounds and combinations of them we make to communicate anything at all, whether from I'm hungry or what is the plan for the universe, that ability to communicate is coming from Krishna. Of course, Krishna himself is known as a supreme linguist. So there are some people in the world who are polyglots, you know, who know 6 languages or 10 languages or 20 languages. But Krishna knows all languages. Of course, he even knows the languages of the animals. Therefore, one can talk to him in any language. And he knows not only the spoken language, but the language of the mind. And Krishna is very fluent in all languages. Krishna can form poetry instantly in all languages. So whenever we speak any words of any kind and form anything in language, whenever we appreciate the beauty of language, whenever we appreciate poetry, the sound of the words, that is all an appreciation of Krishna. Krishna talks about many things that he is in women. He talks about how among women he's intelligence, fame, fortune, fine speech, memory, steadfastness, and patience. So I wanted to think about the patience of women. So I thought about this in two aspects, one that's politically correct and one that's probably politically incorrect. So you can all shoot me later for the incorrect one. So as far as the politically correct one, so women have to be very patient with their children. Of course, men have to be patient with their children also. But generally, as women are the one who get pregnant and who breastfeed, so women generally have more of the patience burden for the young child. And there's a lot of patience required for young children, huh? Isn't it a fact? Yes. So little children, they can have the same book read to them at least 1,000 times. And they will say the same thing 1,000 times. I remember being in a room with a mother and her 2-year-old, and all he said for that whole hour was elephant. 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 So very patient. Patient to teach the child. I mean, how long does it take for a child to walk well? To speak? To use the toilet? To learn how to eat properly? To learn how to be respectful? Say please, say thank you, say I'm sorry. How many times does the mother repeat that to the child? Over and over and over and over again. Thousands and thousands of times over years and years and years. Right? And I usually tell people when they're going to have children, I said, you have 3 choices. You can either learn to be patient, you can go crazy, or you can have someone else watch your child. Right? Those are your 3 choices. So whenever we see this patience of women with their as mothers, with their children, this patience of women, that is Krishna. That quality of patience that the woman has, that is Krishna. And of course, Krishna himself is very patient. We were talking about how the development of spiritual life is like a seed. So Krishna is very patient with us becoming spiritually awakened. He's very patient with our hesitancies, with our fears, with our attachments. Oh, okay, I want to surrender, but not this part of me. Not now. And he's patient. And he's in the heart and he's giving instructions over and over again. Patasmatir Gyanam Apohanam Cha. And if we say we're talking about how Krishna's the resting place, if we say, okay, I need to rest, he's like, okay, I'm the resting place too, I'll be patient. And then he has this supreme patience
Of course, he says elsewhere that he's the Supreme Mother as well. So he has this supreme patience with all of us as his children, that no matter how many times instructions need to be repeated, just like at the end of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says to Arjuna, "Are your illusions all dispelled?" And Prabhupada writes in his commentary that Krishna was prepared to repeat the whole Bhagavad Gita if necessary. So this is the kind of patience that a mother has. And then the other kind of patience that women have is with men. So of course, both men and women have to serve each other. It's not that only women serve men and men don't serve women. I don't think that in any happy marriage the man does no service for the woman. But we do find that generally women are urged to place themselves in a subordinate position to men. And that requires a tremendous amount of patience. Why? Because, you know, men are fallible. Sorry, guys. But, you know, it's... You knew that already. Well, generally men don't know that when they're around their wife, though. So men are also fallible. You know, they make mistakes, even if they have good intentions. And sometimes they may have bad intentions. Sometimes the woman may see, you know, my husband is not even motivated properly in this particular instance. And it's very, very difficult to have the patience to respect the man's psychology, to respect the man's need that I'm the hero of the family, and at the same time keep your own sanity and be able even sometimes to give him good advice and be patient for him to take it whenever he takes it, if he does. So this also, this patience of women, the patience of women with the men in their lives, this patience is also Krishna. And of course Krishna has again this kind of patience with us, that we say to him, "No, I really know what's right. I'm the master of my life. What do I need you for?" I remember taking a walk once in London with a friend of mine, and at some point some woman asked us for directions, and my friend said, "Well, we're going that way, you can join us." So as she was walking with us, my friend, much to my embarrassment, started telling this other woman how she should be chanting Hare Krishna. I was like, "Why are you doing this?" Anyway, so this other woman said, "Well, I don't really think I need to pray unless I'm in trouble. Right now I'm happy. Why should I pray?" And so this is often our tendency of, you know, "I don't need you, God. I already know what I'm doing," right? Just like my mother told me when she was driving with my father, and she said to him, "You know, you sure you know where..." This was long before GPSs. I mean, my parents passed away many years ago at the age of 89, so... Anyway, I said, "Are you sure you know where you're going?" "Oh, yes, 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 I know where I'm going," you know. And she's thinking, he doesn't know where he's going. And he's going on and on and on and on and on. And she told me this story. I was too little to remember it. She said, then I looked at him and said, "It's really funny, dear. The sun seems to be setting in the east tonight." So Krishna's very patient like that with us too. You know, that we say, "I know where I'm going. I'm the captain of my ship. I'm the master of my soul. I plotted out my life. I know everything, how it's going to work out." And he's like, "You sure? How come the sun is setting in the east tonight?" And he's patient. He's giving us intelligent knowledge and memory and forgetfulness. Okay, which other ones did I want to talk about? Oh, how Krishna says he's the Father. Of course, this is very common understanding of God as the Father. Every religion describes God as the Father. But I was thinking about fathers in general. You know, how fathers have this sense of protection and maintenance for their children, pride in their children. And one thing we find particularly with, of course, Krishna says he's the Father and the Mother. Parents in general, fathers or mother, but now we're just going to look at father. That the fathers don't have, generally speaking, envy toward their children. Right? Even if it's a man who's very competitive in the business world, you know, who wants to be better than everybody else. So I was reading my grandson a book yesterday, 10 Up on Top, a Dr. Seuss book, and it was about these different creatures who are trying to balance apples on their head, and they're competing who can balance the most apples on their head. It was a really interesting book about envy. So it ends up with these three creatures who are balancing 10 apples on the top of their head, and then these other creatures get really envious and want to knock all the apples down off their heads. And taking a mop and a tennis racket and all kinds of things, you know. "How dare you balance apples on top of your head when we can't?" At the end of the book, everybody balances apples on top of their head and they're happy. But even if a man is very competitive, You know, I've got more apples on my head than you. Nobody is balancing as many apples on their head as I can. I'm the smartest, I'm the richest. You know, Krishna talks about this in the 16th chapter. Ishwaraham aham bhogi siddhaham. I am the richest, I'm the most powerful, I'm surrounded by aristocratic relatives. No one is as powerful and perfect, as happy as I am. Still, such a man wants his son or daughter to be greater than him. That even that kind of a competitive and envious person is not envious of their own child, generally speaking. Generally. Some exceptions, but generally. The father is happy if the son is greater, as to stand in the background. So Krishna is a father like that. He's not only a father in terms of being the maintainer, in terms of being the protector, in terms of feeling full of affection, but he's also the father that he wants all of us to get the credit even for what he's doing, because Krishna says he's our ability, he's our intelligence, he's our strength, he's our austerities. But we find the Bhagavad Gita, right on the cover, you see this picture, as Krishna is the chariot driver of Arjuna. So there's a very famous story of one man who couldn't read properly. He'd never become fully literate. But his guru, his teacher, told him, read the Bhagavad Gita every day. He didn't know how to read. So he was trying to read, but he's mispronouncing the words. He couldn't understand a lot of the vocabulary. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he was walking, he saw him and he said, what are you doing? You know, what are you doing? And you imagine somebody just going, for sure, it was ludicrous. What are you doing? He said, well, I'm reading the Bhagavad Gita. He said, but obviously you're not reading. It's clear that you never really learned how to read. He said, yeah, but I was told to read every day, so I at least go through the motions. And then he said, well, okay, but why are you crying? He said, because there's a picture on the front of my book of Krishna driving the chariot of Arjuna. When I think how God becomes the servant of his devotee, I cry. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, oh, you are actually reading Bhagavad Gita. You've gotten the real point. So, Krishna says to Arjuna, really, the outcome of this battle has already been decided by destiny. But you fight and win glory. You become the hero. So Krishna, he takes, in this case, the front seat, because it's the chariot driver's in the front, but we'll say the back seat. He's taking it, literally the front seat, but figuratively the back seat, to Arjuna. Put Arjuna as the hero, just as a father would do. Just in that mood of a father. It was very interesting. I was hearing a class, listening to a recorded class of Srila Prabhupada the other day, where he was saying what he says all the time, that all of us are servants, that it's our constitutional nature to serve, that even when we think we're the master, we're really the servant. You know, the president of America is serving the people of America. He's not really the master. He's a servant. And if he doesn't serve us nicely, we won't re-elect him or we'll impeach him. Right? We're really his master, a government of the people. We're all servants. We're all servants. And then Prabhupada said something astonishing. He said, but we don't like being servants. I mean, if you said to people, why don't you train your child to grow up and be a servant? Would anybody like that? Can you imagine? You know, parents, listen, when you grow up, I want you to become a servant. Not generally. And Prabhupada said, what is the adjustment? And it's funny, I'd never thought about that before. For many, many years, I've thought about the fact that all of us have universal desires. We all desire unlimited, unending, ever-expanding pleasure. We all desire knowledge and understanding. We all desire an eternal, youthful, healthy, vibrant life. We all desire loving relationships, trust, peace. You can make a list of universal desires, transcultural, actually trans-species desires, which indicate who we are. It indicates that we are eternal, blissful, full of knowledge, loving beings. But how is it that we have this eternal nature to serve, and yet we have this desire to be a master? How is it that we all have this desire that's contrary to our nature? I never thought about this before. And then Prabhupada said, what is the adjustment? He says, the adjustment is that when you become the perfect servant of Krishna, Krishna becomes your servant. Just like the father, you could say he's the master of the child, but he's also the servant of the child, isn't he? Isn't the father serving the child? What would you like to eat? Oh, you don't want this? Let me get you this. Or what would you like here? What? They're getting the child what they want. Serving the child. Prabhupada tells the story all the time of some man who was waiting to see an important person in the British government. And he was waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. And after waiting a very long time past his appointment, he opens the door. What is this big official doing? And he sees that the official is giving a horseback ride to his grandchild. So in this way, Krishna is the father. The father not just as the master, but the father as the servant of the children. And the father who wants to put the children ahead of himself, who wants to glorify the children ahead of himself, who, like a father, has no envy of his children. So whenever we see any father within this world, even an animal father, an insect father, we can remember how Krishna is the supreme father. If we ourselves are a father, when in our mood of fatherliness towards our children, we can also remember how Krishna is the supreme father. So we've looked at just a few of the things on the list here, and how by meditating on them in the world, we can become more connected with Krishna. So, should we end now, or do we have time for questions?
We have time until 8:30.
Till 8:30, okay. So if there's any other things on this list that you'd like to discuss, or any questions that you have? Yes.
Yeah, I can understand, feel Krishna in father, refuge, and all other things. But I'm not sure about gambling and cheating.
Oh, gambling and cheating. Okay, so Krishna says, of all kinds of cheating, I am gambling. So what's interesting about gambling is it's gone into willingly by all parties. So generally when somebody cheats you, you don't know you're being cheated. Isn't that a fact? Until later. But at the time you're being cheated, you don't generally know. You're not willingly going into that arrangement. You think there's an agreement, but it's different from what you think it is. Whereas gambling's not like that. I just read an article just yesterday about how the casinos are rigging things to get you to gamble more and more and more and more and more. And everybody knows that. Right? This is a published article. This is what they do. This is how they rig the slot machines. So if you spend 70 cents and you win 30, psychologically you think you won. You just lost 40 cents. But instead of thinking you lost 40 cents, you think, oh, I've won 30 cents. And so you keep gambling. And it was even saying how they engineer the buildings with no sharp corners. Because as soon as there's a sharp corner, it's you feel like you're making a decision. And if everything's rounded, you feel like you're never making any decisions. It's fascinating. It's really fascinating. You know, and the kind of sense that they put in the air and the lighting and all. But everybody knows it. Everybody knows. When you walk into a gambling casino, you know that the odds are against you, yes? You know that. So it's a supreme form of cheating. Because you know I'm going to get cheated. You know, but you're willingly. You say, yes, okay. Ah, maybe I'll cheat you. You're hoping. You're hoping that you'll be the cheater instead of being the cheated. So you're going into it with your eyes open. Therefore, it is a supreme form of cheating.
So is it not gambling for the casinos because they know they're going to win?
It's definitely not gambling for the casinos. Yes. That doesn't mean you should run a casino, by the way.
No, I won't run a casino.
Yes.
I think the discussion started in our whole talk was mostly supposed to be about a complete surrender.
Mm.
And I wonder if the love affair that we might have with Krishna can also be an incomplete surrender because of the nature of the love, because we are never going to be completely. I might love Krishna and feel Krishna's love and still and notice the growth, and notice the desire to be around more spiritual people, and notice how I'm less interested in material things, but I still want, and I still have mine. But I don't think that that lessens my relationship with Krishna. I think it forgives me much, as you said, sort of towards the end there, that Krishna's like our dad. And so this concept of ever giving complete surrender, I think is, comes and goes. I don't know if there's very many people that ever achieve that complete surrender.
No, it is rare. Krishna says, Manushyanam sahasreshu kaschid yadati siddhaya yatitam api siddhanam kaschid mam veti taputa.
Is the growth not enough?
And it has to come a point of complete surrender. So it's definitely gradual. Like this, when the seed becomes a tree, that's a gradual thing. It's not that immediately the seed turns into a tree. But there has to be a complete surrender of not being a seed anymore. Of completely, 100% letting go of I'm a seed. And I'm going to stay in this protective coating. And there has to come that point when you know, and when the leaves and the roots break out of that coating, as I said, you can still see it there. If you've ever seen like an alfalfa sprout, and you see a little bit of brown, that's the outside of the seed. Yes. But at some point that has to be jettisoned, even that. So one has to come, it's going to come gradually. It's not that one does full surrender immediately. But partial isn't going to make it. You can't have a partially hatched chick, a partially born child, a partially growing seed. I was thinking in terms of birth also. You know, that you can't partially give birth to your baby. You have to completely give birth to your baby. You have to completely be born. You have to. It can't be partial. It can be gradual. Birth is gradual. The growing of a seed is gradual. But it can't be partial. So, of course, during the gradual, there's going to be a time when it's partial, but it has to come to a point that it's complete. Otherwise, we're not going to be satisfied. It says, Savaipam sampara dharma yato bhaktira hokchache ahoitukiya prityata yadyatma supersediti. This is the only thing that will fully satisfy ourselves, is to fully be who we are. But it is the fear of complete surrender that makes spiritual life so slow for many people, and makes many, many people stay very much on the surface. That you, because full surrender means letting go of the things that we are attached to, but which are harming us. And I don't necessarily mean a thing, although it might be a thing. I mean, it could be some object, but it's more likely a disposition, or a paradigm, or a mentality. That's more likely what we're talking about rather than a thing.
Does so that stand in the way of our relationship with Krishna?
Definitely. Definitely. The things that stand in the way of our relationship with Krishna are basically what kama krodha lobha. Lust, anger, greed, envy, illusion. We talked about Krishna as a refuge. So material refuge are things like lust, anger, and greed, or false ego.
Does he love us any less? Does he love us any less?
Oh no, he doesn't love us any less, but he can't fully connect with us. It's just like, I have people in my life that I love, but because they have blocks to their relationship with me, I can't connect with them very well. It's not that I don't love them. But I'm not even able to forcibly remove the blocks that they're putting up. They have to let go of them themselves. I mean, I'm thinking of people that I love and they have some block, and I may be able to clearly see what the block is, and I may even be able to say to them, this is the block. But unless and until they're willing to let go of that block, my relationship with them is not complete. It's not completely authentic. Yes? I can't be fully honest with that person. I cannot have a fully authentic relationship with them. I can't fully reveal who I am. And they can't fully relate with me. It's not that I don't love them. And I might love them completely, even. And I might even love who they really are without the block. And I might not even be judging them for having that block. I might not be judging them for it at all. Have you all experienced this with somebody in your life? Okay, you love somebody, you have some relationship with them, and you can see what's holding them back, you can see what barrier they have. You have no judgment of them for that barrier. You just want them to let it go. You're not criticizing them for it. And if you say something to them, if you say, look, you know, you really have this problem, they respond as if you're judging them. Yes? Yes. Am I the only one with this experience?
Yes.
And they're just, you know, how dare you say this? You're like, okay, never mind. I didn't say anything. But you have to wait till they are willing to see it themselves and let it go themselves. And it doesn't seem that we can do very much except wait and set an example and put out, you know. And with some people, you really have to wait at a distance. I mean, some people it's so extreme that you really have to love them from a great distance away. And you can't even talk to them. I have people like that in my life. I can't talk to them at all. I mean, as soon as I talk to them, it's going to be a catastrophe. But I still love them, and I wish that the block wasn't like that. So Krishna loves us totally. Some of us he really can't talk to at all. Prabhupada says, for the very materialistic person, Krishna, the heart is essentially silent. So there are some souls that they don't want to hear anything from Krishna. It's not that he doesn't love them. And those blocks are put up by the soul. Does that make sense to you?
It makes sense, but it's hard for me ever to compare a person loving me to God loving me, and I constantly feel that God forgives me for my...
Oh, he forgives, but...
He loves people who have more struggle than less.
But...
I might be delusional.
No, you're not delusional at all, but the question is whether or not you can... That loving relationship can be fully expressed and experienced by the soul. That's the question. The question isn't whether is the love complete, is it fully forgiving, is it that isn't the problem. The problem is can I tie into it? Can I experience it? That's the question. You know, there's electricity in the wall, but can I access it? Am I plugged into it or not? You know, there's Wi-Fi in the room, but is my device turned on? Is the Wi-Fi turned on? I have to be receptive. You follow? Otherwise, I'm not even aware of it. It's like somebody having this unlimited love and unlimited friendship for me, who's right here with me, and I'm not feeling it. So, or I feel it only partially. So that's, and because of that love, Krishna is not going to forcibly take away that block. In fact, you might even say that he's not able to. It doesn't work. We have to willingly be open to see what our blocks are and get rid of them. And that openness and willingness to confront those things is not very pleasurable for the pride. Is that okay? Does that help? And you're right, you can't compare it to human love, but it's something. So it makes it somewhat more accessible, but it's not really comparable. You're completely correct. Thank you very much. Yes. Okay, what does surrender look like? That when you're perfectly surrendered, Krishna will serve you. Well, we talk about the six symptoms of surrender, which are seeing Krishna as your only maintainer, as your only protector, being very humble, which basically means just being very honest, and having full confidence that Krishna is always giving you his mercy and using everything for him. I see it as a real trust. You know, if I surrender, again, I'm sorry to use a human example, but I just think it although it's not comparable, it makes it a little bit easier. You know, if I surrender to somebody in this world, it means that I trust them. I trust that they're going to have my interests in mind, that they're not using me for their own purposes, but whatever they're doing is simply for my benefit. And I trust that they're going to have my back, as we say. So this is surrender, that I trust that Krishna has my best interests in mind, that he's not using me, that he's not trying to exploit me, that he simply loves me, and that he has my back, that he's taking care of me. It's pretty much that simple. Yeah. Again, to take human examples, that in our normal relationships, the child can control the parents through affection. The animal can control their master through affection. I mean, you know, when Srila Prabhupada grew up in India, he didn't see people having pet dogs. That was a very new thing for him when he came to America. He had never, now you see in some of the big cities, but Prabhupada had never experienced that. And he was very astonished to see these, you know, wealthy, sophisticated men in their business suits walking their dog in the morning and standing as they're, and today now when they pick up the doggy poo, which wasn't happening then in the 60s and 70s, Prabhupada would have been even more astonished at this. You're the servant of your dog. You know, Prabhupada said that the big man in his suit, he's standing there while the dog is passing stool. And cleaning up even after the death. Why? Out of affection. Out of affection. Because there's some affection between the master and the dog. That, you know, here when I come home from work, my wife just says, "Ah, oh, you still haven't fixed the faucet." And the dog says, "Ruff, ruff, 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 you're home, you're home." So you're someone who loves me. So out of that feeling of affection, they become the servant of the dog. It's basically that simple. Although in one sense you can say the human is the master of the dog. Is that all right? Yes, this will be the last one.
What you said about surrender, but I was wondering what you thought about when we yield our will to Krishna. In my opinion, that's also deep surrender.
Yeah, so what does that mean, though, yielding our will to Krishna? It's fascinating. Prabhupada comments in the Bhagavad Gita 1 purport, he said we should know what is our own and what is not our own. Really, the only thing that's ours is our will and our desires. That's all. Nothing else is ours. I mean, this body's not mine. Is this body mine? I always find it amusing in the abortion debate. It's my body. It's like, really? Did you create it? How is it yours? So, you know, this body isn't mine. The main evidence is that it can be taken away at any minute. If something's mine, I can hold on to it. And this body can be taken without even notice. You know, if you're going to be evicted from your apartment, I think legally they have to give you some notice, right? Or if the government takes your house with eminent domain, they have to give you some notice, they have to pay you something. But, you know, our body can be taken away with no notice at all and no payment. Obviously, it's not ours. But to speak of everything else, our knowledge can be taken away, all of our possessions. But there's one thing that's never can be taken away, never. And that is our free will and our desires. That's ours. That's ours eternally. That's part of who we are. So, yeah, we give that as a gift to Krishna. And when you give that as a gift to Krishna, you know what he does with it? He gives you his will and his desires. Who ends up with the better deal? So if you give everything to Krishna and he gives everything to you, who gets the better deal? Who has more everything? And Krishna doesn't want our will as a machine. We often say Krishna doesn't enjoy the material energy. What we mean that Krishna doesn't enjoy something that's mechanical. He doesn't get any pleasure out of that. We get some pleasure. You know, I have a computer, I have a phone, and it does what I want it to do. It doesn't say no. You know, but generally we get more pleasure from somebody who can say no. Right? Most people in the world, they don't marry, you know, robots. And there are some people, there are some people who just buy some doll that looks like a woman and live with that. There are some. But not generally. Generally, a man wants to marry a real woman. A woman wants to marry a real man. Yes? Generally? But they can say no. Have you noticed this? They can say no. I don't want to do that. But without that, there's no enjoyment if you just have a machine. So Krishna doesn't want to suck our will so that we become just an extension of him, just doing whatever he says like we're a machine. That's not enjoyable. It's not enjoyable. He even likes being surprised. They say that in a relationship, if there's no surprises anymore, that there's no more pleasure in it. If you feel, I know this person backwards and forwards. That curiosity, that surprise, that learning. So surrendering our will to Krishna doesn't mean we become like a machine or an automaton. That's not rasa. It's not pleasurable. So surrendering our will to him, basically what that means is everything I do is going to be selfless. I'm not going to be exploitive. I'm not going to use you for my own interest in a way that will harm you. I'm going to simply work for your happiness. And then he says, all right, I'm simply working for your happiness.
What a deal.
What a deal. So I invite you to read these verses in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna tells us how to find the divine in the seemingly mundane and spiritualize our life. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.